So let me start thanking the organizer for the opportunity of speaking in such a cool place. So in this short talk, we will give a glimpse about some recent developments dealing with holographic theory with momentum dissipation, and in particular dealing with massive gravity. So the talk is based on these two papers appeared in archive quite a long time ago and done in collaboration with a lot of people, some of them also in the audience. So let's start with a fast introduction. So we already have heard several times during this workshop that momentum dissipation is an ubiquitous and important ingredient in condensed matter systems. And in particular, in absence of momentum dissipation, which is directly linked with the presence of translational invariance, several physical quantities, and I'm speaking about the DC conductivities, for example, are infinite. And of course, once we measure them in real materials, there are no these infinites. So what's the point? The point is that in real materials, there are several factors, lattice, disorder, impurities, that make momentum to dissipate, and in particular, to acquire a finite relaxation time, tau. There is a very simple logic, weakly coupled logic, which we can adopt and which is known as Schroeder model and goes back almost one century ago. And basically, we can imagine the electrons like the characters of our pinballs bouncing against the immobile ions. And the effect of this bouncing is, of course, the relaxation of momentum, which is implemented by this term and by, of course, the relaxation time I was speaking before. And this leads directly to a simple formula for DC electric conductivity, which is directly proportional to this relaxation time. Now, the question is how to transport all this business and what we most like. So how can we import momentum dissipation in the context of the holographic theories that we are all using to mimic strongly coupled phases of matter? So technically speaking, the conservation of momentum is linked with the conservation of the stress energy tensor, and it's intimately connected to the gauge structure of our gravitational theory that we are using, I mean general relativity. So the idea is pretty simple. If we want to relax the conservation of the stress energy tensor, or at least some part of it, we have to break the gauge symmetry of general relativity. And as for a U1 vector, the easiest way to do that is to put a mass to the corresponding gauge boson, meaning the graviton. Of course, it's a bit more subtle than that, because we don't want to break the conservation of the stress tensor completely, but we want to just break the part dealing with momentum and not with energy. So what we are going to do is to take a Lorentz violating version of massive gravity, which indeed does the job for us, putting a finite relaxation time just for the spatial part of the stress tensor. And it turns out that the relaxation time is exactly inversely proportional to the graviton mass, such that in the general relativity limit, this relaxation time is infinite, and if we go back, the conductivity gets infinite again. Now, one point I want to stress is that, of course, playing with massive gravity can be tricky and dangerous, and especially in Lorentz invariant setup, we know nowadays that there is just one theory, which is, let's say, the queen of all the theories, which is DRGT massive gravity, the Ram-Gabadadze Tolle. But this is not true in a non-Lorentz invariant setup. So, of course, this business starts with this theory, probably for fear or for, I don't know, but it's not just the only thing we can do. And I want to stress that the framework of massive gravity we can use and we have to check is way bigger, and it contains way more information than just DRGT theory. Okay, so from the technical point of view, I will be pretty fast, but it's convenient to write down this massive gravity theory in the so-called Stueckelberg trick. So the trick is basically to explicitate the additional degrees of freedom, which of course the massive graviton contains compared to the massless graviton, and reduce the massive gravity theory as a theory of general relativity plus a scalar sector. What scalar sector has to take a particular form, and what scalar sector is of course the sector containing the Goldstone boson, basically the phonons if we want. So the theory can be written down in terms of the scalar, and in particular of a matrix of the scalars, which take these forms. And it turns out that at least in 3 plus 1 dimension, There are just two scalars, variables, let's say quantities, that we can construct from this matrix, which are basically the trace and the determinant. This is not true if we enlarge the number of dimensions, but for the moment, we will stick, and for the rest of the talk, we will stick just to 3+1 dimension because we are interested in, let's say, Cohen-Smarter model. So that said, the most generic action for this massive gravity, or at least for the scalar sector, takes this form where V is an arbitrary function. And V is exactly what Angelo before called P, and can be generically a function which has a priori no constraint. Of course, there will be constraint coming from no ghost, from stability, and blah, 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 but I won't enter this business.
So I and J run from 1 to 3 or from 1 to 3?
No, okay, so we are in 3+1 dimension, where one dimension is the holographic direction, one is time, and two are spatial. So since we are wanna break just momentum, we have just two scalars pointing in the spatial direction. And we are gonna be isotropic, that means that the coefficients here are gonna be all the same. But one in principle can break this assumption pretty easily. Okay, this already allows us to make a kind of distinction between, let's say, solid type of theory and fluid type of theory. And as Red said before, solids enjoy the Euclidean group in two dimension, basically rotation and translation, while fluids generically join a bigger group, which is volume-preserving diffeomorphisms. And this is just a very complicated way to say that if you put a solid in a container, this is going to take the shape of the container, while the solid is not going to do that. And this is very relevant already at the level of the action, because if you go back, there is just one of these two terms which is invariant under this bigger symmetry, which is the Z term. So the action for the fluid cannot contain any dependence on the X term. And this is going to be relevant from the massive gravity perspective because, of course, since we are doing Lorentz violating massive gravity, we can put different mass to different components of the graviton. And in particular, it turns out that in the fluid, the only non-zero mass that the graviton will get is the mass related to the vectorial part of the graviton. While in the solid case, both the tensorial and the vectorial part of the graviton are getting a mass. And this will be very relevant for the phenomenological consequences. So the first thing we want to look at, if we are Cohen-Smarter people, is probably the lecture response. We have, of course, a big dictionary based on Kubo formulas and holographic techniques to extract this quantity. And as I stated before, this is linked to the vectorial part of the action, which generically can be, let's say, determined by three different masses. Of course, stability analysis forced these masses to be not completely random, and at the end of the game, it turns out there is just one mass governing the lecture response, which I call MV. And the conductivity, so the DC electric conductivity, meaning the conductivity at zero frequency, takes this form, which is kind of typical for all these holographic theories. I don't want to enter the details of the structure of this formula because it contains way more that I want to say in this short talk. One thing that I want to stress is that this mass is not zero, both in the case of the fluids and in the solids, because it depends both on the derivative of the two objects that I wrote in the action. Another very important thing is that what controls the phenomenological property of the conductivity is basically the radial dependence of the gravity of mass. And this is why DRGT is too restrictive, because in principle, we have the freedom of choosing different function, giving different radial dependence for the graviton mass. And this will determine for us basically the dependence, the temperature dependence of the relaxation time and of the DC conductivity. This is basically due to the fact that these quantities are all horizon data, meaning that this is the radius of our horizon. And therefore, the radial dependence of the graviton mass is converted in the temperature dependence of this object. Okay, then we can make some assumption on the graviton mass and say that this is just a power law, and we can of course construct explicitly how this power law depends on our action, and in particular if we take an action of this form, this is the relation basically. Okay, so let's go to the phenomenology. So as you see, the DC conductivity can depend on the temperature in several ways, and basically the derivative of this object in function of the temperature depends exactly on this new power that we were building before. So there is a value which is actually the most famous linear action theory, which is this line here, where this quantity is basically constant in temperature. And moving the value of nu up and down this threshold, we can have, let's say, materials which where the conductivity grows like temperature, and materials where the conductivity drops down with temperature. Of course, you see there is an annoying bound here, which has a very nice story, but it's a material for another talk, so I don't want to enter these things. One other very exciting thing is that without the needs of any dilaton, additional scale, additional field, vector field, or whatever, we can already cook up a situation where the resistivity starts linearly in temperature, at least for small temperature. Another thing we can notice is that there are additional features also in the optical conductivity, and all the time the DC conductivity drops down with temperature, there is an additional peak growing in the middle infrared region, which is to us quite mysterious, and still we don't understand really what the hell is this peak. So if you have suggestion, please let me know. So this was the part of the electric conductivity which probably is the most known and the most used, but there is more. Of course, the graviton contains more degrees of freedom, and we can even study what is known as viscoelastic response. So viscoelastic response is basically, we take a displacement vector, so we move a bit, let's say we deform a bit our material, and we can construct a tensor, which is called the strain tensor, which is basically the symmetrized derivative. And we can study the response of our material in function of, stress. So we apply a stress to our material, and we want to see how the material responds. Of course, fluids and solids respond in a very different way, because fluids respond with a constant shear velocity gradient, and the response, the coefficient response, is indeed the viscosity, while solid responds with a constant strain, and the response is basically elasticity or the rigidity modulus. Of course, nature is way more complicated than that, and there are examples where the response is mixed, and this is exactly what is a viscoelastic material. So in our model, moving the graviton mass and the ratio between the graviton mass and the temperature, we can, let's say, run towards all these examples where this is the viscosity normalized to entropy, and this is basically the dimensionless rigidity over pressure. But I will go back to this in a moment. Then there is just a technicality. Of course, from the holographic point of view, we can get these two quantities quite easily, and there is a full dictionary that allows us to do that. And it's pretty nice that there is a kind of agreement between our experimental colleague and we theorists. And so the point is that, first of all, this kind of response is encoded in the transverse sector of the graviton, which are basically these two modes, they're decoupled from the other one. And the mass that is governing everything here is the tensorial mass, so the mass associated with this component, which depends just on the x derivative. So as we know before, this is going to be zero for the fluid case and non-zero for the solid case. This is basically the equation governing everything. This is the famous equation giving rise to the famous eta over s ratio. But you notice here that now this equation, it becomes massive. And this mass is going to have a strong effect on the phenomenology. So the first thing I want to notice is, of course, if the mass is zero, meaning we are in a fluid type, then we don't have this mass term. The rigidity is zero as expected, and the eta over s ratio is our beloved 1 over 4 pi. On the contrary, if we start to mess up with this mass, the rigidity is going to increase, as I will show in a moment, and the eta over s ratio, whatever it is, eta, and in this framework, is going to drop down. And additionally, we can compute quite easily the speed of sound of the bulk phonons, and we can see that it's indeed directly proportional to this mass. So one point that I want to really stress is that the violation of the eta over s bound is not directly linked to momentum dissipation. Because we can cook up models where momentum is dissipating, but the eta over s ratio is 1 over 4 pi.
Not the converse, right? I mean, you make your s less than 1 over 4 pi without momentum.
Well, I mean, you can think about higher derivative, Gauss-Poinet stuff, or these kind of things. But it's a different, I mean, it's a different game, yeah. Okay, and this is basically in plots what I was showing. So this is the rigidity modulus, and it's growing in function of the mass. Sorry, here, this is the tensorial mass, mt. And we can have even an analytical estimate, at least a low mass, which is this dashed line. The other interesting thing is that, as I was saying, the eta over s ratio, so this is our 1 over 4 pi, is dropping down in function of this graviton mass. And the curious thing is that it's quite different from, for example, these higher derivative and Gauss-Poinet cases, because in those cases, the violation is not arbitrary. Here, we can arbitrarily violate this bound and even go to zero eta over s ratio. And this actually happens always, well, not always, in our theory, always, at zero temperature. So in our theory, basically, momentum dissipation is present even in the streamer case. That means that the eta over s ratio is always going to zero at zero temperature. This is not the case if, for example, momentum dissipation is, let's say, blocked at the streamer case. And this will correspond to have basically an ADS4 emergent geometry in the IR in the streamer case. So one, of course, now one question that everybody is asking itself is, can we find a generalized bound? Is there something more? So of course, Sean and colleagues put out something like that. So the idea that actually is realized also in our more generic model is that the eta over s ratio scale will drop off with temperature at zero temperature, but never faster than a power law scaling like 2. Where this delta, big delta, is basically the scale in the infrared which survives in the streamer limit. So right now we don't see any violation of this fall off, and it's quite surprising that no matter how we change the potential for the graviton, this fall off is always 2. We also try to put it out from a different perspective, a kind of generalized bound, which is, let's say, more simple in a way. So you can notice, of course, that the eta over s ratio is going down with the mass, while the rigidity or elasticity is dropping up with the mass. So the question is there, let's say, a combination of these two guys which generalize the eta over s ratio in a case where the material enjoy viscoelastic response and not just visco response. And this, it's just very preliminary, it's just an idea, but I'm happy to listen, let's say, comments about this. Okay, just to wrap up. So one important question is that, I skipped during the talk is, what the hell massive gravity is really mimicking, because it's a very nice, effective way of introducing momentum relaxation. It's very easy to do computation in this framework, but of course, we want to understand what is that? And in particular, is there a connection between massive gravity and disorder model? Because massive gravity, people try to connect this with some kind of mean field disorder. So imagine you have a disorder system and you average over this disorder, and the result is some effective mass for the graviton. But of course, one question is, for example, can we distinguish between the averaging on a lattice or the averaging on a completely disorder material? And is the fact the same? Are both the theories giving a mass to the graviton? Can we do, let's say, a distinction? Another, of course, very nice question, which is connected with the previous talk, is we have a lot of very nice theories from the holographic perspective. We can do superconductors, superfluids, stripes, whatever kind of instability. But we are missing probably the easiest theory that we know. So where is the theory of elasticity in holography? So can we build up an effective field theory in the bulk, which encodes elasticity and phonon physics at the boundary? So can we build up something like an holographic solid? And this goes back to, let's say, a wider question, which is all the framework of constructing holographic effective field theories for condensed matter system. And in more specific, for example, we can address a lot of questions which now are very hot in this audience, in this workshop, and in all the paper you can find in archive lately, which is all the questions about this universal bound and scaling that, of course, we all love. And it's very interesting to see if in more generic effective field theory, from the holographic point of view, these bounds are respected, why or why not. And of course, the last thing that we always want to aim is, can we find correlations between different quantities or predict something, which, you know, also our experimental colleagues will be proud of us. And I think that's it, so thank you.
Can you tell me, what are the known ultraviolet consistency conditions on ratio of mass?
Okay, good. So this is a tricky point, because all these this Lorentz violating massive gravity theory that I spoke about are usually effective field theory. So there is a cutoff. And there are recently some attempts to construct, at least for some cases, of this Lorentz violating massive gravity, some UV completion. But it's still an open question, and we don't know the answer.
But if you just give one link diagram, where do
they belong? Well, it depends on the theory. So the cutoff, usually, it's the ratio of this gravity mass compared to the Planck mass or something like that, with some power. Well, I mean, it depends. You're talking about holographic theory? Or?
Yeah, in ADS. Right? So I'm asking because, mm-hmm. you know, presumably, if you make them arbitrarily large, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right? And that's where the
yeah. Is. So, of course, if you put m very big, then of course you have to put higher derivative, let's say correction. And the question is, of course, which is the m at which you have to put that. And if you have to put that, of course, then you have to add everything, and then you don't have control on the theory. So it's one thing that probably. I can rephrase your question is, of course, the limit of very strong momentum dissipation, which is the mass very big compared to the temperature, can be tricky and maybe not reliable for this reason that you're saying, because maybe the theory is not reliable at that value of the mass. But I cannot say anything more, I mean, honestly.
Just because you mentioned it, so actually, there was a Chinese paper that I think has some kind of examples.
Yeah.
It's a T-squared bound.
Yeah, if I read it well, this is just in bigger dimension.
I don't
because actually I checked, because I'm aware of that paper. They put some hyperscaling, and the claim is that the hyperscaling theta can change these things. Mm-hmm. But if I'm correct, this is true just for D more than 2. So it's not how in the case you consider and we consider, I think it's, but yeah, that's true. There is this paper.
So, go back, so you found, G, yeah. So actually, what about eta times G? That might be quite natural. So because G is like the susceptibility corresponding to eta, right? G mm-hmm. is like the real part of the mm-hmm. xyz, mm-hmm. that's what it is, right?
True.
So actually, in a way, maybe eta times g is even more natural than eta over x. So I mean, that's because s, well, eta times g, is
by zero,
I mean,
zero,
divided right? by yeah. g, or I don't know, whichever, yeah.
But it would be zero in a fluid, like in, I don't know, take right or nostrum. That would be zero, right? And not 1 over 4 pi.
I mean, think about the smallest is no longer tied to the horizon, right? So the natural thing would be somehow, if something else measures the difference between eta and the horizon, and this flow you now get, this thing has a mass, then that might...
But somehow P is just the pressure?
Yeah.
So I mean, it's a bit of an asymmetry, because like, so eta is a dissipative term, and...
Yeah, this was just to construct some dimension.
No, yeah, but I think it's a nice idea. I mean, it's natural to try to put G in there. Certainly once translation is very important, I think it's very natural that there's G in there.
I mean, we have told a lot about this. That was just an idea. And of course, I mean, just looking at the plots, it's kind of natural to...
Something that comes up in another context is connectivity. So people try to think about connectivity bound a while ago. They got the connectivity divided by the charge susceptibility.
Okay.
That turned out that came out.
We should be in fusion,
and,
right?
But sigma is to eta like chi is to g, I think. So
I see. But in that case, I don't know how to recover the limits where g is zero, right?
Yeah,
because it's like,
yes.
I don't know.
So this curve you have would work it over in Spanish, you would find a value of m.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any instability there somewhere?
No, actually, this is not very. I mean, I should have done it more carefully. If you do it more carefully, the real parameter that you consider is this, and then this curve becomes basically. So, if you plot in function of m over t, eta over s, you start from 1/4 pi, and then you go, let's say, at infinity, so at zero temperature. Or wait, well, let's say when the temperature is way, way smaller than this, then you go to zero. And this is quite generic for all the theories where momentum dissipation is still relevant in the extremal limits. So there are cases, for example, Q lattices, where the geometry becomes again ADS4 and in the extremal case, and then here you don't have this kind of behavior, but you have a kind of behavior where the value of eta over s is smaller than 1/4 pi, but it's still finite.
Right, but I was considering,
okay,
if you found some case where
this
can advantage that finite value of
m over t,
then.
Yes. As far as I know, this is not possible.
It's expected to be forbidden by, like, unitary legal
quality. That's it.
I guess, look, like, the axiom models, the QLATS models, which give rise to a mass, they correspond to solids in your classification. Mm-hmm. So what sorts of sources give one of these fluids? I guess it's clear from...
Yeah, actually, that's an interesting question, because, for example, holographically written down, like, with the scalars, it would be very easy, because it would be just, you know, the imagining four dimension. And it would be just a determinant of this matrix I call J. So you have just to write down basically the determinant of this object. And this, from the bulk point of view, this would be a fluid. Of course, there is a big question here, which is we are playing with bulk. So and this is basically the question connected with phonons. That from the bulk point of view, it's pretty clear that these are phonons. But from the boundary point of view, of course, we are putting some. When we do this, basically, we are putting a source. So the translation are not broken, for example, as Luca showed in a spontaneous way. This is clearly an explicit way. And it's not trivial at all how to recover these kind of things. And this is connected also to the fact that they were describing before. So what we are putting is basically ISO-D global in the bulk. So in principle, if you want ISO-D in the boundary, you should cage it somehow in the bulk. And I don't know how.
So it's still turning on linear sources for these fields, but you've got some sort of non-trivial kinetics.
Exactly. So what is modified is the action.
This
is, let's say, compulsory if you want to retain shift symmetries, homogeneity, isotropy, and blah, blah, blah. Yeah. But of course, it would be nice to study, let's say, imagine you put this kind of theory plus the other part. And then if you study the excitation, you should see that, I mean, if you put a small parameter here, basically, you should see that the difference between transverse phonons and longitudinal. So the speed of sound should go to zero when you have of the transverse one should go to zero when you have just this term. But I think that this could be interesting.
It's the DBI action.
It's pretty nice that it's even constrained by some symmetries. So it's not a that's true. And actually, there is another nice point, which is that actually. If you take a potential like this, okay, so the potential that give rise to the linear resistivity, at least at low t, is exactly here put in the square root, which is exactly dBi. So one somehow can imagine that, of course, dBi has a non-symmetry, and maybe this non-symmetry is connected to the linear t resistivity, but this is just speculation, you know. Yeah, I see.
Okay, let's thank Matteo again.